and welcome to the How I Rehab podcast, brought to you by the Sportsmap Network. I'm your host, Nick Kane. I'm a sports physiotherapist, and it's a pleasure to host you on our podcast. And for those that missed the last episode, talking around the rebrand, yes, we have rebranded the podcast, but the emphasis remains on trying to cut into some of the depths that's needed when it comes to difficult cases and case scenarios. Rehabilitation within the sports setting, and just chatting to some of the best practitioners from around the world who are either working in sports or working with the athletic population. So nothing changes with that today. We're having a great chat with Stephen Patterson. And those who don't know, Stephen is a professor in allied exercise physiology and performance at St. Mary's University in London. He's also the course leader and professional doctorate in strength and conditioning, and he lectures in strength and conditioning. He's a PhD in the area of blood flow restriction training, and that's what we'll be talking to in depth with him about that today. And he's been researching this area for over 10 years. He's published over 70 scientific research papers investigating the strategies to improve performance in clinical groups and elite athletes. So I guess blood flow restriction training has clearly become very popular in the last however many years. There's probably no one better to speak to and getting some guidance around that from Stephen. So plenty of great insights we'll utilise within our rehab in the lower limb is largely where we're talking to today. So unfortunately, we won't have the footage of the interview. So for those on YouTube, we'll be just purely listening to the audio, and otherwise we'll be just tuning in across our podcast platform. So please enjoy this chat. And, you know, before we do move into the chat, you know, I like to mention around our Sportsmap Masterclass platform that we think it is the best product out there around providing great clinically relevant and practical-based education for those physios with a real keen interest in sports who are trying to excel within their career and push forward and, I guess, fast-track for where you're at. Why? Because I think it's basically taking, you know, you as a viewer into a room where you get to see an expert work through an injury or a pathology where you get to see the visuals of, you know, assessments to rehabilitation exercises to what they look for in the imaging. It's something that you can really pull plenty of great takeaways, and that's really outlined within each masterclass. So really, you know, it's there for you guys to try for a free 7-day trial. Otherwise, it's just $30 a month to get access to all the content, which is now 30 plus hours of content that you can just have at your fingertips. And you know, that ranges from some of world-class experts from Craig Purdom to Jordan Maniguchia, Peter Maliaris, Ebony Rio, and with upcoming masterclasses for the year on PCL from Tim McGrath, Ben Ashworth just being released on the athletic shoulder, Shane Kelly on calf injuries in the track athlete, Mike Lancaster from Harlequins Rugby on the calf injuries in the rugby athlete, Eamon Delahunt from Dublin University on chronic ankle instability to Neil Welsh and Colin Griffin from the Sports Surgery Clinic in Dublin, Seth O'Neill and Achilles and Claire Robinson on patella femoral, just to name a few of what we're expecting to come in 2024. The videos are 60 to 90 minutes long, so they're punchy. It doesn't take you all day to get through it, and there's plenty of other benefits from being a member for that $30 a month, which includes free access to our upcoming online event, which is called the Problematic Plantar Fascia. Otherwise, it's a $30 fee to jump on, and that's with Henrik Real, Athol Thompson, Roman Turillon. We'll be talking through plantar fascia and also some of their subsequent issues around post-surgical release or post-rupture of a plantar fascia and how that might influence our management. So really looking forward to that, some of those guys who are experts in their fields in what they'll talk to. So just another added benefit if you are a member of the Sportsmap Masterclass platform. Otherwise, looking forward to that event coming soon. Very exciting news is that our newly released Mastering Muscle Rehabilitation course coming to the UK. So it's being held at the Wolverhampton University. The facilities there are fantastic. Brand new track, brand new gym, and our all-star lineup coming in June the 22nd involves Seth O'Neill speaking to the Achilles and calf complex, Shane Kelly on calf strain injuries in runners, Rowena Johnson on the imaging side of things, Steve McClear on rec fem and quad, and Ben McDonald from Wolverhampton in the EPL speaking to hamstring injuries. And those who follow the literature will know, obviously, there's Shane
Ben and Steve all had a huge, huge part in the British Athletics publications coming out around soft tissue rehabilitation and injury, and Seth and Rowena speak for themselves in the space of what they have done over the years. So this is going to be a two-day course, highly practical, basically lecture into workshop, lecture into workshop, seeing what they do to assess and, I guess, monitor injuries throughout a rehab space, as well as the rehabilitation exercises, how they pull it all together into the end stage of performance and running mechanics, and making sure we are being comprehensive in our approach to soft tissue management. So very limited places for this. It's the 22nd and 23rd of June 2024, the University of Wolverhampton. Limited places remain. I think there's 10 or 12 at the moment left. So getting quickly, we're looking forward to coming to the UK for this tremendous event.
All right. So as mentioned, Stephen Patterson around blood flow restriction training. Thanks for tuning in to the How I Rehab podcast and hope you enjoy this one. Welcome, Stephen, to the How I Rehab podcast. It's a pleasure to have you on board.
Thanks very much for having me. It's great to speak to you finally.
Now, Steve, do you want to fill us in a little bit on your background? You work at St. Mary's University and I guess where the interest came into blood flow restriction training.
Yeah, so I guess like most students, I started off interested in sport and then get into sports science. And I guess it was during my undergrad, really, that I started to get into research, did a few projects for people, and that really picked up my interest. And from then, did a couple of studies at undergrad and master's level, which both got published, and that led me into wanting to do a PhD. I was actually doing a PhD in a really strange, well, not strange area, but different area around heating older people in hot baths to improve their muscle efficiency. And we got to a stage where there wasn't really other work to be done in the area, and I started to read around how we can increase muscle mass and strength. And one of the areas that sort of piqued my interest way back, must be about 2006 now, was blood flow restriction. And that's where we sort of started to get into it, and ended up doing my full PhD in blood flow restriction training. And then ended up in academia after my PhD at Loughborough, moved to London, to St. Mary's University. And I've been there ever since, mainly on our MSc strength and conditioning program, which is a distance learning master's. And then now I run the professional doctorate, which is a PhD program in strength and conditioning also. Whilst working remotely here in Belfast.
Nice, Steve. Now, I guess what we're going to chat through today is mostly around the rehabilitation practices and the uses of BFR. But to kick us off, did you just want to tell us a little bit about the benefits of BFR and what is it? So outside of hypertrophy, are there other benefits of using it and some of those key elements there?
Yeah, look, I guess blood flow restriction, in its really basic sense, the biggest benefit is allowing you to get specific adaptations with using low loads or low intensities. And that's this really basic premise. So for example, when you're injured during rehabilitation, when you can't lift heavy, we can get similar gains with regards to muscle mass, especially strength, more or less, but obviously heavy loading is better, to heavy load exercises. And again, other applications as well with aerobic exercise, where again, we can use lower intensities, around 50% VO2 max, and again, drive similar adaptations to high intensity aerobic exercise. So I guess that's probably its main benefit and probably why it has certainly piqued an interest from a rehab physiotherapy type background, because in those certain situations where an individual is load compromised, we can start to use blood flow restriction much earlier than we can heavier loading, and start to progress the individual back much quicker.
From a physiology standpoint, what's actually going on at, I guess, both the cellular level, and there is some research that touches on around a hormonal response. What can you tell us around this?
Yeah, look, I think one thing to just make clear is blood flow restriction from a purely adaptations perspective, what's happening in the muscle and, you know, from strength and size perspective is actually pretty similar to what happens with normal resistance exercise. It's like, I know it sounds a bit cliche, but it's not really magical. It's not better than anything else. It's just a different way to do it. Essentially, what's driving a lot of the adaptations is probably that local hypoxia or ischemia, because we're reducing blood flow. So obviously, we're applying a tourniquet to the proximal end of the limb. We're reducing blood flow into the limb, preventing that venous return, so preventing the blood back to the heart. And then that drives this hypoxic environment, which essentially means as you start to progress and do more repetitions, you fatigue much earlier than what you would do with those normal low loads, which would take you a lot more repetitions. So that reduction in blood flow, that reduction in oxygen, then starts to lead to greater fatigue. As with regards to what's happening within the muscle itself at a cellular level, the adaptations or the responses are pretty similar. You know, we see similar gene responses that we would do with heavy load training. So there's no real difference in that. In some cases, it may be ever so slightly delayed in some of the early work that came out, sort of the early 2000s, mid-2000s, suggesting that some of the gene responses happen a little bit later than what they would do with heavy loading. Although I would take a little bit of a caveat with that in the fact that we probably weren't optimized for blood flow restriction training then. You know, people were just applying random pressures and so on. So I would probably argue that's not the case. And if we look at the adaptations that happen, they happen at a similar rate, if not faster. So I don't think that there is a delay in that regard. Other things, you know, one of the early things that really sort of picked up people's interest, and mine too, was around the idea of, you know, growth hormone responses, these circulating hormones that you see changes with. And to be honest with you, they don't, whilst they show a big increase and they do increase with blood flow restriction exercise, they're generally because of increased effort rather than leading to any adaptations per se. Stuart Phillips' lab out of Canada has done a lot of work which shows that these circulating hormones aren't really relevant for adaptations. They you know, it's a local response that you get. So for example, if I train my right leg with blood flow restriction, it will get bigger, but my left leg won't. Now, there might be a slight increase in strength because of a neural cross-transfer effect, but the adaptations will happen local to the tissue that's been trained. So therefore, these hormonal responses aren't really relevant to the adaptations that you see with any type of training, basically.
Okay, so taking that in mind, Stephen, and with the recent increased popularity around PFR, how are you seeing practitioners using it at the moment? Do you think we're using it to best practice? Or do you think it's sort of gone a little bit too far in some elements?
Yeah, look, I think things have definitely changed and got better. There's no doubt about it. If I look back, we did a survey study with Chris Brandner and myself, who's out in Australia. And we did a survey study a few years ago just to find out what people were doing. And actually, we were quite surprised at some of the responses. Whilst generally people were doing things correctly, there was a lot of strange stuff happening, which I think is what always is going to happen with this type of work. So we put together a group to sort of try and bring together a bit of a consensus around some guidelines. So we put a guidelines paper out, which was out in Frontiers, I think, in 2019. And I certainly think things have got a little bit better then because there's a bit more clarity on what we should and shouldn't do. Now, I've recently done a bit of a tour around the UK to a lot of Premiership football clubs and rugby clubs and so on. And whilst most people are still doing things correctly, there is still some things that you're not really sure why people are doing. And I think there becomes a bit of a habit where we just apply blood flow restriction into everything, thinking it's going to be this holy grail that's going to improve everything. I think the key things are understanding the physiology of how it works, and then that gives you an indication of how and when you should apply it. And like anything else, it shouldn't be applied continually. I'm never stating that this is the go-to tool that's the only thing you can use. This is applicable in certain situations, and it will give you adaptations. And once you can return them back to normal training, that's always my go-to. Get back to what you know you should do as an athlete, specifically, you know, lifting heavy and everything that benefits that come with that. Blood flow restriction is only just an adjunct to get you there, rather than being the continual thing that you would use all year round.
All right, let's chat around ACL. And I guess, when is the best opportunity to use BFR in an example of an ACL post-operative rehabilitation? How early can we start using it, or how early is too early?
Yeah, look, again, one of the things about that is it's very dependent on where you're based. I know that sounds a bit strange, but you know, a lot of ACL rehab's dictated by the surgeon and when they want them to start, and I guess what setting you work in. So for example, here in the UK, and our research that we've done in the area, we normally start, we had a criteria based upon when we would start. We would normally start between 2.5-3 weeks post-surgery. That was our sort of go-to. If you're in America, you're probably starting 1-3 days post-surgery. So there's a really big disconnect. And it's not that one's wrong and one's not. I'm probably at the side of we can probably wait a week or two before we start. Ideally, what we're wanting to do is see some swelling come down following the surgery. Because one of the things that we do know is when you do blood flow restriction, because you get blood flow going into that limb and we're preventing the venous return, in the immediate aftermath of the exercise, you know, an acute sort of 12, 24 hours basis, there is a an increase in swelling of that tissue, which does subside. But obviously, if you already have increased swelling, you have to be a little bit careful there that you're not sort of causing too many problems. So we would normally hold off and start maybe, you know, 10 days, 14 days plus, and give the tissue and give the joint time to heal from the surgery rather than just jumping immediately in, especially in an ACL where we're not really trying to get someone back much. You know, we know all the evidence out there about returning people much quicker than 9 months. So really, is it worthwhile to, you know, to increase and use BFR in that stage when you're not really trying to return them much quicker? It's different if you've got other injuries, but I think from an ACL, I would definitely wait a couple of weeks before I would start.
Okay, let's maybe use a different example. Patellofemoral pain or a bit more of a degenerative patella-related issue, might have some chondral change or what have you, really struggling to get some good load in, so it would probably benefit well from using BFR. Talk us through optimal exercise selection and optimal loading. Is it worthwhile if it's like underloaded and the exercise is at quite too low level, or clearly there's a ceiling effect? So what's our optimal load in using BFR for these type of injuries?
Yeah, certainly. I think, you know, the exercise selection is going to come down to what the individual can do, what their range of movement is, you know, swelling, all these other factors that are sort of you're going to see as a result of early stage rehab. From a load perspective, ideally you're wanting 20 to 30% of your maximum. Now, that's, you know, academic speak of, you know, making sure that you're testing these things and so on. But realistically, we don't even need to worry. If you use the standard repetition scheme, which is 30 repetitions with 30 seconds recovery, and then three sets of 15 with 30 seconds recovery in between, within one session, you will work out whether the load is correct or not. We will be able to use that and determine if they're able to do, say, 75 reps and they said it was really easy, well, then you know the load's too low and you need to increase it the next time. If they're doing sort of 45 reps or less over the, you know, out of those 75, well, then you know you've went too heavy. Ideally, you're in that sweet spot between 50 and 75 reps. You would get, once they can do 75 reps multiple times, then you can start to increase the load. So within one session in a rehab setting, you should be able to work out load without having to test anything or worry about anything like that. Now, I do have an issue with, there's a few studies out there looking at things like body weight training only, and it doesn't really show that much of an effect. Now, I'm not saying that that wouldn't have an impact when you're severely load compromised, but the idea would be to start adding some load at some stage, you know, not being just doing body weight type work. But one thing that does happen with blood flow restriction, especially you're talking about a patellofemoral pain there, we have now observed that we are seeing a big reduction in pain immediately post blood flow restriction. So it's driving some adaptations and some mechanisms with regards to pain inhibition. And actually what that does is then that allows us to, when we go into our second and third exercise, it actually allows us to do more and actually increases or decreases the pain afterwards. And we've seen that it can occur for up to 24 hours post-exercise. So that helps again then with regards to allowing us to do more exercise. Like depending on where you are, again, in the world and how you use it, it really depends. So for example, I think over in Aspetar, in Doha, they're using it in a way where they would use blood flow restriction as their first exercise in someone who has a pain condition, and they would reduce the pain from doing the blood flow restriction exercise because it's tough, and then they would load heavy afterwards. So for example, a tendon exercise or so, or a tendon issue. Whereas, so you can either use it in two ways. You can either use it to reduce the pain to allow you to do more work, or you can use it when you're load compromised, but you will get a reduction in pain after that.
All right, well, now we touched on rep scheme there, so 30 repetitions and three sets of 15 with 30 seconds rest in between. But if we go back a step, talk us through a little bit around the setup, optimal pressure within the cuff and cuff placement, and anything else that sort of fits with those elements of optimizing setup.
Yeah, of course. I think like this is one of the, I guess, the main things, and probably where you see a lot of the discrepancy across the board, or certainly have done in the past. From its most basic sense, we're applying a tourniquet to the proximal end, so as high up the limb as you possibly can, either the leg or the arm. Obviously, that's the reason for that is because it takes it away from any nerves, and there's more fat and muscle at the top end of the limb, so therefore there's less chance of any compression injuries or anything like that. The biggest thing is pressure, and it is probably the biggest thing that we've pushed on and probably changed a little bit over the last little while. Again, we did another survey study with Brendan Scott recently where we actually looked at what people were doing, and based off some of our guidelines, we think we've changed the way people are doing things with regards to pressure. And I'm a really big advocate of being able to measure that. So we would use what's known as limb occlusive pressure or arterial occlusive pressure. And essentially what we do is we inflate the cuff, depending on which one you have. There's automated devices. There's you might need a Doppler for other devices if it's just a handheld pump. And you would inflate that until you don't have a pulse and you can't hear the pulse anymore. We would classify that minimum pressure to stop all blood flow as 100%. And therefore, we would work at a percentage between 40 and 80% of that during the exercise itself. So that would mean that there's still blood flow coming in, but it says preventing the venous return. So we don't need to work at, you know, a pressure well above that. What that does is it individualizes the pressure. So I think, you know, if you think about it, if we were all to go to the gym now and lift our one repetition max at a percentage, if I made everyone lift 100 kilograms, you know, for you, Nick, and for me, that might be completely different loads, and our maximum, therefore, the repetitions we can do is going to be dramatically different. And the same thing happens whenever we're applying blood flow restriction. If you're just applying, if we start applying arbitrary pressure of, say, 200 millimeters of mercury, well, for you, that might be over 100%, and for me, it might be under, and therefore, the repetitions that we can do are different. So 40 to 80% is where we recommend. Generally, you probably need slightly higher pressures in the legs, probably 60 to 80%. And certainly from the pain stuff, and we can talk about later, we suggest that you need higher pressures. It seems to have a greater benefit. And then the upper body doesn't seem to require as much. It's sort of 40 to 50% limb occlusive pressure. So applying the pressure and how we set that up. Now, what I would say is, if you have an automated device, you can do this every time you come in because you just hit a button and it does it very quickly. But I understand that that's probably not the quickest thing in practice to do. So I don't think you need to keep retesting limb occlusive pressure every single session. What I would argue, though, is depending on who you're working with and what you're using blood flow restriction for, if you're driving, you know, a hypertrophy response, you're trying to increase muscle mass, well, as the limb gets bigger, obviously the pressure to restrict all blood flow into that is going to be reduced. Therefore, I would recommend that you maybe reassess it every few weeks if you see, you know, marked increases in muscle mass, because therefore there's going to be a slight change. It's not going to be huge, but it's recommend, you know, I would definitely recommend that you keep updating that. So it doesn't have to be every session, but every 4 weeks maybe, and just reassess it once, and that will give you a good indication of where you're sitting at. Then when you come to the repetitions themselves, we're talking that 75 repetition scheme is probably the most simplest thing to use, especially in rehab. You can do sets to failure. I did that in my early PhD, and it's fine, but all it does is it doesn't seem to add any greater adaptations per se. It's something that you can use every now and again as a bit of a test to see if people are increasing the before you increase load, for example. But I actually stick to the 75 reps. And then if I'm able to do 75 reps two or three times in a row, I will then increase the load. And when you're increasing the load, it's ever so slightly based off the percentages that you're working at.
So just confirming around setting up your limb occlusion pressure, that 60 to 80% is purely based on before you start the exercise. We're not necessarily measuring occlusion pressure whilst doing an exercise. Might be an obvious question, but just want to check off.
Yeah, so if you measured it, say your limb occlusive pressure came out of 200 millimeters mercury, you would then set that down to say 80% of that, and then you would apply. So you obviously release it after the 100% test. You would wait a few minutes, then you would inflate it again back up to what 80% is, and then that's what's maintained during the whole exercise. Now, obviously, during the exercise itself, if you imagine you've got pressure coming from the cuff and the tourniquet onto the limb, when you do a contraction, it adds more pressure. And that's where equipment comes in. You know, cheaper equipment doesn't regulate pressure, whereas more expensive equipment does regulate pressure because it's constantly trying to adjust it based off just the way it works. So the pressure does fluctuate during it, but it has a standard pressure of 80% or 60%, whichever you decide, would be maintained throughout. And the key thing is the pressure is maintained throughout all the exercise sets and all the rest periods in between. We only release the tourniquet once we've completed our four sets.
Steve, where are we at on the optimum level of training or frequency of training? Is this something you would recommend doing daily or every second day for the optimal outcomes? Obviously, with strength training, when we are lifting really heavy loads, we might encourage a day's rest for that tissue regeneration. Is this something we can use more regularly?
Yeah, look, again, it's very dependent on your own current situation and where you're working. And again, what you're trying to do, what the sort of the aim is of the outcome. So generally, 2 or 3 times a week, just like normal training, you know, you're bringing them in 24, 48 hours recovery in between. 3 sessions a week is sufficient in order to gain specific adaptations over a period of time, 6 to 12 weeks, again, like any normal training. It does open up the advantage of potentially using it from a high frequency perspective. Some really good work came out in, again, mid-2000s, late-2000s, sort of showing that we can use high frequency once or twice per day for 2 to 3 weeks and being able to get substantial gains in muscle mass, you know, in a very, very short time frame doing that sort of high frequency type training. But that's not open to everyone because obviously if you're not seeing your patients every day, if it's an outpatient clinic, you're not going to do that. If it's inpatient, obviously you can see them and you can do that much greater. But like everything, there's diminishing returns. You know, if you're able to do that for 2 or 3 weeks, you're not going to be able to continue that on for a long period of time. So because you're not going to get the adaptations anymore. So you have to balance it out of, if I do 3 weeks and I get a big increase in muscle mass, has strength caught up? And actually, am I then going to be able to transition them into something different at that stage? It depends on the injury. The more recent work has shown that actually what we can do is the adaptations tend to occur after between sort of 5 to 10 days. So there's some really nice work that's been done where you may be doing a high frequency once per day for 7 days or so. Then you have a week of almost a deload and then you do it again. So you don't probably need the 3 week high frequency. We can probably get away with doing it for 5 to 7 days, a recovery period, and go again. Personally, again, I think where the high frequency type work can really fit quite well is prehab. So if you're going into surgery, so rather than doing it in the immediate aftermath, because again, it depends how often you see them, if you can get someone to do a high frequency prehab plan before surgery, I think you've sort of maybe put yourself in a better standing before surgery. Because you get your date for when you're going to have your surgery, you've got a short period of time. Can we use it? Can we get some adaptations? Which then means that after surgery, again, you can take that window of a couple of weeks afterwards because you don't, you know, you've already got some adaptations banked that we don't need to worry about after the surgical period.
Mate, so we use this typically early on until we sort of graduate back into sort of lifting some heavier loads, as you mentioned. But can you give us an example where maybe we might use this, you know, a bit more of a periodized scheme, maybe cycling it back in at later stages of recovery or if the athlete's full function? How and why would you go about using it in a scenario like that?
Yeah, look, one thing I would say, and that is, you know, one of the really interesting things around that is that you can obviously always go back to a high frequency approach. So another way to approach that is, you know, you do your normal rehab plan, and say it's post surgery ACL. We've started 2 or 3 weeks post. We've done a sort of 6 to 10 week block of blood flow restriction. We are returning heavy loads back into the training itself. But say there's still some asymmetries, you know, 5-6 months down the line. Well, maybe then that's the opportunity to add a high frequency block, you know, maybe a week to try and sort of stimulate some muscle hypertrophy to decrease some of those asymmetries between limbs and so on. That is the way it can potentially be used. And then, as you said, in season training, again, if there's a specific reason, if there's a specific reason why you want to do it, maybe there's a bit of downtime on maybe matches you're playing and so on, you've got a final or whatever you're looking to do, again, there might be some scope to do it then. But that's probably where it fits in those sort of short windows if you're going to do that high frequency.
Is there a product out there? There is so many to choose from. Is there a product out there that you might recommend from a standpoint for using occlusion pressure? We don't have any associations on this podcast, so purely just on what you might recommend or even what you use.
Yeah, so we use probably one of the most expensive pieces of equipment on the market because it's a surgical tourniquet company from Delphi. And we were actually using that before they became a blood flow restriction specific device. And we had bought their surgical tourniquets and systems because we wanted to really make sure the pressure we were applying was correct. So we would go there because what it does is it auto-regulates pressure. It has limb occlusive pressure built in, all of the different factors, and from a safety perspective, which allows us to actually lower the pressure that we use whenever we're doing blood flow restriction exercise. And that's our go-to, and what we've been using for years now. There are many other equipment manufacturers on the market. There's quite a lot now. Certainly in the last maybe even 3 or 4 years, it's really increased quite dramatically. They all come with their own inherent issues in that they don't generally auto-regulate pressure. So the pressure you apply against that device increases pressure and so on. Sometimes the pressure that you see on the devices aren't necessarily the pressure that they say they're given. So we've measured some devices where you put a pressure sensor inside them and what they say on their screen is not what's being applied to the limb. So but one thing I would say is, and a lot of the companies are doing it now, I would be pushing for something that can automatically measure limb occlusive pressure and so on. That is probably one of the strongest things to be doing. So making sure that you have a device that can do limb occlusive pressure. Now, you can still do it handheld, and there's absolutely no problem with that. But obviously, all the faffing around and all the issues when you're doing that for the first time can, add a lot of time to it. So a device that you can just hit a button and you can be confident that it's going to measure limb occlusive pressure accurately is something I would be aiming for. And there's a lot of devices in that sort of £100 to £200 mark. Sorry, I haven't got the conversion rate, Nick, for Australia, but that sort of ballpark is where you can get quite a few devices in that range. And I would probably be just making sure there's a pressure measurement or a limb occlusive pressure just for my own safety, and also because it's a bit easier to do it rather than having to constantly use a Doppler each time. But you can do that.
Steve, you mentioned safety there a couple of times. Is there anything we should really be aware of when it comes to safety using occlusion training? And I guess, that's for both in clinic setting where we might potentially send a patient home and where they'll be doing it unsupervised in their gym, or likewise in an elite sports setting where they might be doing it around some other injuries or maybe contusions or what have you. What are some of the key safety elements that we need to be aware of?
Yeah, look, there's a range of different, safety issues. One of the things that I've relaxed a little bit more over the years around safety from a perspective of, it was actually some of the surgeons were sort of almost saying, like, we do things that are a lot worse for longer periods of time. And if you think about blood flow restriction during resistance exercise, that 75 rep scheme with 30 second recovery lasts anywhere between sort of 5.5 to 8 minutes. So, that's the length of time that you've got a tourniquet on before you release it. Again, the biggest issue and the biggest concern's always been around blood clotting and, DVTs and so on. Because there was an old sort of thought process that when you go into surgery, you're at greater risk of blood clots after surgery. And there was concern that maybe it was the tourniquets that were causing that. And actually what we know is that actually the tourniquets are antithrombolytic, i.e. they reduce blood clotting risk factors by increasing antithrombolytic factors into the blood itself. So it's not that BFR causes blood clots by any stretch of the imagination. That's not been proven. It definitely doesn't happen. But what can happen, obviously, if you do have a blood clot and you have this restriction of blood flow and then you release that cuff, you could move one. So it's trying to screen for things like that to make sure Now, I'm not saying people, again, need to use a Doppler to screen for a blood clot. But again, if you think about post-surgery, that's maybe why you want to wait, you know, 7 days, 10 days before you start to make sure that there's been no carryover of the surgery and there hasn't been any DVTs, because they happen because of stasis. So because we're just lying in a bloodless in a pool there. So that's what causes some of that, those issues. Other areas are maybe around some individuals with some nerve damage and so on. Again, that can be some issues with regards to applying blood flow restriction to that area. But what you're finding now is, like everything, there's more and more research coming out as people are applying this into different groups, and therefore that causes almost, you know, makes us a bit more sort of safe in what we're doing, because actually we've got more evidence that we can use it in certain situations. I think the key thing is, if you are applying standardized pressures and following specific guidelines, you are reducing the risk quite a lot. The other thing that we do see, and we've heard of, not heard of, but we've, you know, people have proposed, is we get a pressure, pressure reflex response. So immediately post exercise, you're increasing the pressure during blood flow restriction, because you're restricting blood flow. And obviously, if someone has higher blood pressure, therefore that can cause a pressure reflex response. So there are people to be very careful with. But again, that comes back to the equipment. Again, probably the more expensive the equipment, the more it auto-regulates, it reduces that that pressure response that you get. So it falls into, and it helps with regards to safety. And that's why I'm saying, you're ideally with blood flow restriction, you're trying to use the lowest pressure that's going to give you an adaptation. Okay, so that's what we're ideally trying to do, rather than just sort of applying more and more pressure. So there are safety screening guidelines out there. Ben Rosenblatt from, was at the Institute of Sport and the Football Association in England, he had a paper out in safety and some guidelines, and there are some other stuff within our paper as well, which you can look up and cover. But generally, safety isn't a major concern. I think where safety comes in, especially that last thing you mentioned around when people go home and use it, that's probably my biggest concern. I've always found, and maybe it's a bit sort of naive thing to think, but I've always found that people do stupid things, even no matter what we tell them. And that's probably the biggest thing, you know, as a practitioner, if you're going to give something home to someone, it's making sure they understand what they need to do. So for it may be that rather than sending them the percentage of pressure that they have to do, you have to give them the exact number and tell them to dial it up to that, because otherwise they may get it wrong one day, or they may do something silly. So it's trying to make sure that people don't do something silly when they're away from your own guidance. That's probably the key thing, where things are going to go wrong, because people just get a bit, you know, we find, especially in athletes and others, they like to compete. So we have individuals who compete in pressure and try to inflate pressure up more because someone else has done it without thinking about the individualized approach. So that's where things can generally go wrong, because people are just too competitive and trying to compete against each other, and pressure, repetitions, all those other factors.
Steve, there is some research, I think, by Paul Head, who maybe worked under you, being one of them, around combining occlusion training with other modalities such as neuromuscular electrical stimulation or COMPEX, for instance. What are the added benefits here for us? And do you use this, and where can we use this in a clinical setting?
Yeah, we've actually just had a PhD student, Paul Head, who's just completed his PhD. He had his Viva just before Christmas, and he's got a few things to correct. But he did his whole PhD in neuromuscular electrical stimulation with blood flow restriction. And we'll be putting some papers out in the very near future. I guess it the one issue around in neuromuscular electrical stimulation is just where it fits and you know where you apply it. It works, you know, certainly if you apply neuromuscular electrical stim and you add the tourniquet, we actually get an increase in muscle mass and strength, and Paul's got some work to show that, and there's a couple of other papers, Natsumi and a couple of others, that have shown that exact same thing. So that's definitely something that can be done. I guess the biggest thing around the neuromuscular stim is, where does it fit within the programming? I think Jeremy Lonicky put out a nice sort of paper it was a long time ago now. I keep forgetting how long this has been going on for, but you know, sort of doing a passive mode and then moving into the aerobic and then moving into resistance exercise and sort of saying this is the you know, the direction of travel whenever you start a rehab plan. But actually what really happens is everybody jumps straight to resistance exercise because it gives you the most bang for your buck in the shortest period of time. And as long as someone's got, as soon as someone gets any range of movement, that's when they move into the resistance. So what I would say about the neuromuscular stim, it won't add anything more than what resistance exercise does. But if you have a situation where you are limited in your ability, say range of motion, well then maybe you can apply neuromuscular stim early. And we have had a few case studies with some footballers in the past who've been using it during periods when they're in a boot or in a cast, where you can potentially apply it to offset atrophy. And I think from what we've seen, I'm 100% confident. I know it's a bit maybe overconfident to say, but I'm pretty certain that we can offset all atrophy by using your muscular stim during periods like bed rest, boot, when you've got a boot on, when you've got a cast on, those sorts of things. It's just about where you can apply them and how, you know, it gets a bit awkward with it. But certainly that's something that we think and when it can be used. And a little bit like the other exercise, it's between 40 and 80% of limb occlusive pressure is where you need to be. And actually some of Paul's work, again, it's not published, but we think you're sort of, you maybe don't need as high a pressure. So probably between 40 and 60% of limb occlusive pressure seems to be optimal for adaptations based on some of his work out of his PhD.
I think this is a really interesting area, and I think a number of our listeners will be interested to learn more about this. And well, Paul Head actually did a lecture for SportsMap back during COVID on one of our online conferences, and that lecture is actually still available on our YouTube page, so I'd recommend people have a look at that. But to break it down, Steve, into a clinical scenario, and if I use ACL again as a case example, early days they might be more doing some, you know, quad lockouts and just to try to keep that muscle activated, so to speak. In this setting, we're suggesting we can use occlusion pressure with the neuromuscular stimulation ramped up, and we're going to get much greater effects from doing that around reducing muscle loss. Is that a fair comment?
Yeah, 100%. Now, Paul's work, you know, is really basic in some regards from the perspective of how we, you know, tried to apply it and tried to control things. It's very much lying passively without any exercise at all. So it's just the stimulations doing all the contraction of the muscle. But obviously, if you can contract with it and do some sort of low-level activation type work, probably for me, that's where it fits. And then the minute you can go back into normal resistance exercise, then that's when you would transition. Again, the key thing is just thinking about, again, go back to that safety idea of, especially post-surgery, you want to make sure there's no DVTs, because at the end of the day, that's when you're applying, even if it was resistance exercise or neuromuscular stim, you're still applying the blood flow restriction at that stage. So that's just the one thing to be aware of. But again, it's very rare and it's not, you know, you wouldn't see much of it happening. So it wouldn't be a major concern. And as I said, in America, they're starting literally days 2-3 post-surgery. So, you know, it is dramatically reduced risk in that regard.
Really beneficial and informative chat so far, Steve. We'll start to wrap things up, but I just wanted to touch on when we're talking around a more distal segment from the tourniquet. So far in this chat, we've largely talked around the quadriceps. Is it still just as beneficial for a distal segment such as a calf? And how can we optimize and use it best according to a lower limb, ankle or calf injury?
Yeah, certainly. There's no reason why it shouldn't be. Actually, my whole PhD was in the calf, really strangely. We did all calf work because we measured blood flow as well within the calf, and actually that's where we could measure it from. So my whole PhD was actually doing exercise in the calf itself. So if you think about it, even though you're applying the pressure at the proximal end of the limb, it's still, the calf will still be under blood flow restriction. So in theory, there's actually no difference and you'll still do the 75 reps, it'll still come out the same. The biggest issue you have with something like the calf is the fiber type makeup of it, because there's the soleus and the gastric and a different fiber type makeup. It probably doesn't hypertrophy to the same extent as what you would see in a quad as quickly. So, and you know, it's all based on exercise selection, whether it's, you know, bent knee or straight legged. So that's going to be the big factors around how quickly you see responses in that regard. But certainly from a strength perspective, they get stronger really, really quickly. So you will see no problems whatsoever using things like calf more distal, as long as I said, that muscle is under blood flow restriction. That's the key thing. It won't have any effect on that. It should be as effective.
So, and in doing so there, I'll be using the same rep scheme, so 75 repetitions, and there's no real change in that. I guess if you can tolerate still 30% of your load, you'd be doing a single leg calf raise with load, or it might be a double leg calf raise with the tourniquet on the one side. Is that how you'd go about it?
Yeah, exactly. So it's the 75 rep scheme. Again, once you can load a little bit, once they can do the 75 reps multiple times, you know, we increase the load slightly, and that will end up being around your 20 to 30%. As I said, you don't have to measure that 20 to 30% of your one rep max, because within one session, you can gauge load based off the repetitions that they're able to complete.
All right. And I just wanted to touch on, I guess, tendinopathy. Let's use patella tendinopathy. And we know there might be some benefits in using occlusion for pain and also for hypertrophy, which will hopefully reduce, I guess, tendinopathic pain. But is there any research out there around, I guess, loading of the tendon itself and the best ways to optimize that and in so utilizing occlusion training?
Yeah, look, if you were to go back again to the early days, I think there was a study that came out of Japan, I think by Kubo, by 2004, and they suggested that basically they compared blood flow restriction to heavy loading and suggested there was no adaptations to the tendon. And everybody shied away from the tendon then for a long period of time in that regard. I guess it got a little bit more of a look in around some of the pain work, because again, we were able to show reductions in pain, and people suggest, well, maybe we can use it there to reduce pain. And again, what's being used in certain situations is we'd use it before, it would reduce pain, and therefore people can then load, which obviously the tendon potentially needs to load, and therefore that's given adaptations in that regard. Because by reducing that pain, you're getting some stimulus through the heavier loading. There is a group in Germany, Christopher Sentner's lab, who've now done a couple of studies. They've done it both at the patellar tendon and the Achilles tendon. Slightly longer durations, probably sort of, I think about 14 weeks of training, with, I guess they've just fixed some of the things that people were maybe doing in the early days around pressure and progressive overload and things like that. And like, it sounds really silly, but most of the early studies, there's no progressive overload whatsoever. It's just, here's the load, here's the pressure, and they're going to keep the same things for the whole entire duration of the studies and still find out, you know, the adaptations. So things can always be optimized. But they were able to demonstrate that the patella, or the tendon, sorry, was able to increase cross-sectional area, as well as patella strength or tendon strength as well. So they're showing adaptations within the tendon itself, both at the Achilles and the patella. Now that's in healthy tendon. Whether there's been nothing that I'm aware of, there's a few case series around more tendon ruptures and rehab, but that's obviously having more of an impact on the muscle itself. So as far as I'm aware, I haven't seen anything. I'm confident that there's work currently ongoing in the area, but I haven't seen anything around, you know, tendon adaptations in individuals with tendinopathies and other areas. But the tendon in theory should adapt. I guess my only thing, just to be, again, just take it back ever so slightly, is I don't think there's an injury that I can think of off the top of my head. I'm sure there will be people listening probably have them, that you would need blood flow restriction on its own for 14 weeks without doing anything else, which is what, you know, the Sentner papers have done. So I don't think you're ever going to use blood flow restriction for a period of time that you're ever really going to need to do BFR on its own and then show that it's got these tendon adaptations. But what we can be probably confident of out of those recent studies is that even if we're only using it for 6 weeks, 8 weeks, 12 weeks, whatever it is, before we transition into heavier loading, is that the tendon is getting loaded and certainly not detraining. So there probably are some adaptations happening, but we're just not necessarily needing to measure them, if that makes sense.
Steve, it's been a really tremendous chat and broken down into great detail around how to use BFR. You've certainly covered off the ins and outs of, you know, when to utilize and prescription around it and the benefits. Is there anything that I haven't asked around that you think is really important to pass on to our listeners?
Yeah, not that I can think of. But probably as soon as we end the call, there'll probably be a few things. but not really that I can think of. I think the key thing is like blood flow restriction is really simple. Okay, it really is. It's not a complicated thing to do. It's not overly tasking to set up. But it's just making sure that you have a really good clinical reason and clinical understanding of why it is you're applying it. I think there's too many times that we just apply things because we think, well, if we just add more, it's going to get better and all these different things. One of the things I should probably say is the number of exercises that you choose is probably going to be really interesting. You know, there's, I'm not saying that it's happening a lot, but, you know, I've heard of cases where people are, you know, running blood flow restriction only sessions, and therefore they feel that they have to fill up the full time of their rehab session with all blood flow restriction exercise. So they end up doing 6-7 exercises, which is complete overkill. You know, if you look at nearly every research study, it's one exercise. As we've moved more rehab specific, it's turned into 2 or 3. But I think 3 is maximum number of exercises that we need. And I actually think that's probably even a little bit too much. Again, it's going to depend on your exercise selection. If you have something that's multi-joint and you're going to use multiple muscle groups, well, then you can maybe use a multi-joint exercise and then isolate a specific muscle that you maybe need. Obviously, if you're doing all isolation exercises, then you might have to do, you know, more exercises in order to get the stimulus across, you know, say the full lower body. But I think that's probably the key thing. You know, you don't need to keep adding more and more and just doing more and more exercises. And if you're doing more than one exercise, just like you would with any other exercise, release the pressure after the last set and wait, take 2 or 3 minutes before you move on to the next exercise. By the time you set up the next exercise, then you've got, you know, 2 or 3 minutes recovery, reinflate the cuff for all those sets again for the next exercise. But don't keep the tourniquet on continuously, you know, whilst you're moving from exercise to exercise, because then that means it will be inflated for 20, 30 minutes. And that's far too long for what you're trying to do.
Steve, brilliant way to sum up a tremendous podcast, mate. And we really appreciate you coming on board for this chat. We know you're a busy man with a lot of the teaching you do and the research and everything you have on at the moment. So I'm sure our listeners are very appreciative of you to be able to pass on the information. Again, thanks for being part of the How I Rehab podcast, and we look forward to hearing from you down the track a little bit more and talking around this topic. So a big wrap and thanks from all of us. Thanks, mate.
No problem at all. Thanks very much for having me.